Welcome to the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota. This is Arts and Cultural Heritage producer Jeff Carmack, and in today's installment, we're going to be talking about the importance of preserving the oral history of Minnesotans. Every family has an oral history. It's what goes on around the Thanksgiving dinner table. There's often much more to it, and it just takes a little bit for folks to open up, and if it's recorded, then generations from now can get a better picture of what we've gone through and what our ancestors have gone through. Well, today on the phone, I'm joined by Ryan Barland, the Minnesota Historical Society Oral Histories Project, and we're going to talk about just that. Well, welcome to the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota, Ryan.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah. So you're coming to town to the Stearns History Museum and for the Breakfast Club to discuss oral history. So why don't you give us a little background about the Minnesota Historical Society oral history and, you know, why this is so important?
Yeah, that's a great way to start off. So oral history has been a department at the Minnesota Historical Society since about the late 1960s. We've been collecting interviews from folks since, you know, the 40s, since really recording technology made its way to the Midwest. Basically, it started with interviewing the rich and the famous Minnesotans to kind of grow our collection and hobnob with famous people and all those kinds of fun things. It's since evolved since the 60s to what I like to think of a more democratic view of history is that, you know, oral history now really serves to tell the untold stories that aren't present in the Minnesota Historical Society collection. You know, our mission is really to capture and preserve and educate about Minnesota history, but we can't do that if we don't have, you know, history for certain groups of people or certain stories. And that especially comes up in immigrant oral history or immigrant groups in Minnesota who, you know, don't really know much about the Minnesota Historical Society, don't know, you know, that we're here, what we can provide for them, and they don't have things to give to us. What everyone does have, though, is stories, and, you know, we try to engage with those folks to really get oral history or get them into our collection via oral histories. We also use it from time to time, you know, to help out individual families and such with, you know, genealogy type things, interviewing grandparents, interviewing family members to kind of save those stories. And that's a lot of what I'll probably be talking about on Wednesday at the Stearns County Historical Society, kind of the do-it-yourself oral history, you know, for friends and family members and personal research kinds of stuff.
Yeah, it's actually pretty easy to do that. All you got to do is start talking, and you know, we found that you know through the book Minnesota 13, Elaine Davis, I've interviewed her a couple of times, and one of the things that she told me about how, you know, after a couple of years after her book came out, you know, people started to loosen up a little bit about some of these, you know, family histories, you know, because it's just about everybody up here in Stearns County was in some way involved with bootlegging. And, you know, now all of a sudden, you know, grandpa or great uncle or somebody at Thanksgiving, you know, those stories start to make a lot more sense. You know, to kind of come back to what you were saying originally about interviewing the famous people, it's kind of like the New Yorker had their profiles for a long time. And, you know, yeah, some of these are really famous people, but some of them are just regular folk who are just doing something. But it's that thing that they're doing, which is actually kind of amazing.
You know, and that's really one of the biggest challenges that, we have as a state institution, you know. We don't have the budget to interview every single person that has a great story, which is, you know, a real shame. I wish we did. I get, you know, calls all the time about, you know, bootleggers or gangsters or, you know, all of these people that have lived incredible lives that haven't made it into the newspapers. You know, they're not going to write their own book. But they've lived an interesting life that's, you know, worth getting down in a story, if only for their family or, you know, for the community around them. And so that's where, you know, local oral history is in a lot of ways really as important as, you know, anything else. So
absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, we find that everywhere. Everybody's got a story. So so what are some of the tips you can give interviewers if they're going to, you know, say they got, you know, grandma or grandpa sitting around and they're like, well, I'm going to do this. They've got a, you know, they've got a lot of history that you've got a lot of interesting things that happen. I think I'd like to talk to them. What are some of the tips that you would give?
Yeah, so, and it kind of goes back to what you were saying earlier about, you know, the stories coming out now that are kind of starting to make sense, or they're, you know, starting to open up about these old distilling these old bootlegging stories. You know, it the person you want to interview really has to want to be interviewed. You know, so for me, it always starts off with just having an informal conversation. You don't, you know, bring a recorder with you or anything. You just kind of say, hey, Grandpa, you know, I'd really love to interview you and, you know, hear, you know, have you tell all the stories that you've been telling me since I was a little kid, you know, about World War II, about bootlegging, about whatever it might be. And, you know, I'm just going to record it and we're going to keep it around for family. And, you know, like I said, you can't make people give oral histories, and being interviewed is not something that most people are familiar with. And so that combined with, you know, kind of the Minnesota nice, Minnesota, you know, private. I'm not important enough to interview. You know, I get that from my own grandparents a lot. And so it's a lot about, you know, the first step is always just kind of getting the person you want to interview on board. And then, you know, the next part, you know, and I still try to do this before I ever turn on a recorder, is to kind of talk to them about what stories we should talk about. You know, with my grandpa, it's a lot of stories about working for the railroad, you know, and things like that. And in talking to it, you start to find out other things that I, you know, either make a mental note of or jot down for when we actually turn the recorder on and get the oral history down. You know, I've already kind of mapped out, you know, a lot of the main questions that I want to hit before I ever start interviewing.
Yeah, then you never know sometimes with those tangents. They can just kind of go, and then, you know, well, and sometimes it's waking up memories from folks, too, that, you know, they hadn't thought about something in a long time, but one thing leads to another, and then there you go.
Totally. No, and one of the things that's hard for me, because I hate awkward silences, is, you know, kind of letting people finish their question and not immediately throwing another question at them, but letting them, you know, kind of come to the end, letting them pause and think about what they just said for a second. Maybe they're debating telling you something. Maybe they're thinking about it a little more deeply. Maybe they have something very interesting, you know, that they'll end up saying if you give them, you know, a couple seconds to kind of quietly think about it and reflect. I've gotten some of the best answers to questions have been after they've already talked about the subject for a few minutes and thought they were done, but decided to come back and say some more.
Oh yeah, yeah. I've experienced that many a times here. There was once a veterans project that the state was putting on, and I talked to some folks up here at St. Cloud State who were involved with, you know, student veterans, and there were three of them in the studio. And at first, it was very, very straightforward. I mean, there were, I'm sure you know how this goes. You ask them a question, yep, and they give you yes as an answer. And I'm like, I don't want that. You know, but it, you know, they're doing their thing, and they're not exactly comfortable. I mean, these are vets. These are you know, combat vets who are now students. And after a while, after about, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes, they loosened up, and then they just started to roll. And so then, you know, in the editing process, you know, I don't think you've necessarily got the time restraint that I do. I got a half hour. And, okay, you know, after they loosen up and then they go for, you know, like another half hour, 45 minutes, I'm like, okay, well, now I've got a different problem. I've got to see what, you know, see what I could put in. So when it comes to the oral history and the stories, you know, the time limit type thing, is there a time limit, or is there some kind of format that somebody might want to follow, or do you just kind of let them roll?
That's a great question. Normally what I do is I try to kind of chronologically go through a person's life. So, you know, one of my first question is always, when were you born, and tell me about your childhood. And, you know, kind of move through that. I try to spend the majority of the time on, you know, those important years where I know that's where the meat of the story is going to be. And then I try to end with, you know, general reflections and hopes and more of the kind of ethereal kinds of things. As for time, I think that, you know, it's really whatever people feel comfortable talking at. You know, I think anything under 15 minutes is probably just a conversation. Most people don't have the capacity to tell much more interesting material after about 2.5 hours. So that's about the cap. Although I think in our collection, we have a few oral histories that are upwards of 14 hours. And I think that's a little on the crazy side.
Yeah. It can get a little epic. So
yes. To be honest, I have not read or listened to those, and can't even imagine what someone could talk about for 14 hours. So,
well, you never know. Never know.
Yeah.
Today we are talking with Ryan Barland from the Minnesota Historical Society and Oral Histories. He's going to be up in town at the Stearns History Museum on Wednesday the 10th for the Breakfast Club at 9 a.m. And they do have a light breakfast there, too. They don't just call it Breakfast Club because it's early in the morning. But the oral history collection, so is there a collection? Are these oral histories something that the public can check out or listen to?
Yeah, they definitely are. We were one of the first large oral history departments, if not the first, to go completely digital and put our entire collection online back a couple of years ago. And so we're pushing about 2,000 interviews now being online on our website, mnhs.org. They're completely searchable. You can read the transcripts of them. You can listen to the audio. You know, we've been doing projects, like I said, from the 60s, and we have interviews from as early as 1949 from all over the state of Minnesota. I was looking just for fun the other day, and it looks like we're pushing about 200 or so Stearns County specific interviews. I'm sure there are some that I couldn't quite find, but yeah, so it's a pretty robust collection. And yeah, it's a great resource that's completely online, for, you know, family genealogists or, you know, researchers, History Day kids, the whole gamut.
Yeah, there's quite a lot up there. I'm looking on the website here right now. It's more than just audio things, too. There's, you know, the Moving Pictures Films project on there, and the In Your Own Words. Yeah, it's quite the interactive website here. You can do quite a lot. You guys got the timeline up there as well. I just clicked on that. That's pretty neat. A little interactive timeline.
Are you on the Becoming What Minnesotan?
Actually, no. I'm on the Minnesota's Greatest Generation. That's what it looks like.
Ah, that one. Yeah. Sure. Yep.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Quite a few. Because what I did, this is probably what a lot of people end up doing too. I just, you know, typed in, you know, Minnesota Historical Society oral history, and clicked on the first thing that came along, and yeah, there we go.
Yep, and you know, however you get to it, is always interesting because everyone searches the internet uniquely. If you're searching for something in particular, I always just have people go to the front page, and then in the upper right corner, there's a little search box, and you can type in Stearns County. You can type in the Albany Roller Mills, you know, the Powerline Project, Latinos, or a person's name. And if there's an associated oral history project, it's usually one of the first things to come up in the search history, which is really great for me because it drives a lot of our online traffic to oral histories.
Once again, you are in tune to 88.1 FM and the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota, where today we're sitting down with Ryan Barland from the Minnesota Historical Society Oral History Project. Ryan's going to be in town this Wednesday, June 10th, at the Stearns History Museum to present it to their Breakfast Club about oral history. Breakfast Club takes place at the Stearns History Museum at 9 a.m. And you can expect to hear more about some of this and other interesting stories. Well, what are some of the more interesting oral histories that you have run into?
Sure. Personally, my favorite project is, it's called the Forest History Project. It was one of the earlier ones that we did in the 1960s with 40 or so aging lumberjacks from northern Minnesota. These guys are in the 60s. They're in their, you know, late 90s, early 100s. They spent their whole life in northern Minnesota chopping down trees and living the very stereotypical lumberjack life. And they're pretty candid about their stories about, you know, working hard in the camp, what camp life was like, you know, having too much fun when they weren't working, spending all their money, and having to go back to the forests the next season. And it's partially because they're so old that you really get what, you know, lumberjacking and the North Woods were like in the early 1900s. You know, they really, they're actually very eloquent storytellers, which is kind of interesting. So nice. That's one of my favorites. And then similarly, we have some Kensington Runestone oral histories.
That's an interesting one too. I've often wanted to do a story on that. I haven't been able to get around to that yet. You want to give a little bit of detail about what that is? Because it's kind of a mystery.
Yeah. And no matter what you think about the Kensington Runestone, I think the best part of the story is, you know, the debate about it. So the Kensington Runestone was discovered in 1898 in Douglas County by Mr. Oman, I believe, O-H-M-A-N, a farmer in the area. The particular stone has Viking or Scandinavian runes on it that supposedly prove that Vikings made it to Minnesota hundreds and hundreds of years before Columbus or any of the other European European ancestors. So discovered in 1898, pretty much since then there's been a debate amongst archaeologists and runestone experts and all kinds of people about whether or not it's fake or it's the real deal. And there are convincing arguments on both sides, and it's one of those things that probably will never be definitively gone either way. We've got a few oral history interviews with the son of the fellow who discovered the Kensington Runestone, and a few other people who live nearby. And you know, it's interesting to hear their side of the story.
Yeah, definitely. The first time I heard about it, I was just like, "What? What is this?"
Yeah,
but it is plausible in its own way. So
sure.
Yeah, you know, somebody could have just followed the Great Lakes all the way to the end and then wandered out into the prairie and buried something.
Mm-hmm. And it's almost like clockwork. About every 10 years, someone comes out with a new book about why it's real, or you know. And 5 years after that, someone comes out with a book disputing all of that. So it really is, you know, the Kensington Runestone is the gift that keeps on giving.
Absolutely. Maybe that was the intent.
There you go.
Whether it was the Vikings who buried it or, you know, otherwise, you know, it's a thing. It's there. So.
Yeah. And at this point, you know, it's part of, you know, Minnesota history, and it doesn't really matter if it's real or not. The journey is the fun part.
Exactly.
My only thought, and not to give away my entire Wednesday presentation, but you know, oral history is not rocket science. It's 90% of it is just kind of following through with wanting to do it. You know, the technical aspects are not that difficult. You know, use whatever kind of recorder you're comfortable with. There's no magic questions you need to ask. Ask the questions that make sense to you. That's why you're the expert interviewing the person. You know more than myself or any professional oral historian would. And, you know, interview people because you're genuinely interested in learning and preserving their stories. And that's, you know, in a nutshell, really what it's all about.
Nice. So let's say that you've got somebody who has already recorded some oral histories, and you know this is a possibility. People do this, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. But they've got it on a format which is really, really old. Say reel to reel. Does the Minnesota Historical Society have, you know, the technology to transfer those kind of things? Just because I'm thinking, just because we used to be able to do that down at KVSC, but I'm pretty sure there's not a reel to reel down here anymore. And you know, my folks, they've got reel to reel sitting around here and there. So it's like, well, that's just sitting there now. So
yeah, no. And actually, that's one of the biggest problems in kind of these old formats is that it's not so much that they'll break and decay, the reel to reels. It's that the reel to reel players are disappearing, and they're not making new ones, and they're not fixing broken ones. So what's more likely to happen first is the reel-to-reel players will disappear and the old reels will just be unplayable. We can point you in the right direction of some folks. Our reel-to-reel player recently broke as well, and we have another one, but we don't take in outside stuff. But I'm always happy to talk people through it. If you've got the equipment at home, it's a pretty easy process of digitizing the reels or the cassette tapes yourself, actually, and preserving them that way.
Nice, yeah, because that old technology, it's we've been recording stuff for a while. How about wax cylinders? Could you pull something off a wax cylinder?
You know, it's pretty amazing. You can. One of the most interesting things that the Smithsonian just kind of developed is a new technology that doesn't actually touch the wax cylinder. It just creates a scan of the indents that are made in the wax cylinder that create the sounds or preserve the sounds in the wax. And so it basically takes an incredibly high-resolution scan of the wax cylinder without ever touching it, and then through a lot of complex computer algorithms can recreate the original sound. So wax cylinder, you know,
that's awesome.
It's pretty cool. Yeah,
that might actually be easier than, you know, doing a reel to reel or magnetic tape or something.
That might be what happens, you know, in however many years. That might be all the undigitized reel to reels have to be done to as well. It's currently a very new process. You know, I think it's like $500,000 to get one of these machines. So I think it's rolling out very slowly, but that might be the great hope of, you know, some of these endangered old formats.
Yeah, because it's like, you know, people were recording stuff a long time ago and sitting around, and now, you know, it is. It's collecting it and storing it. And, you know, it's those kind of, you know, things that you think about, you know, those processes, you know, how is it stored? You know, we always think of like a book, you know, but even books deteriorate over time. So.
Oh, yeah. No. And, you know, and I guess another bit of information, depending on how deeply people want to get into this, it's more of a thing for, you know, local historical societies. We always tell people to have follow a 3-2-1 standard with, you know, their archival material. So three copies of an object, two should be on a different media, so a paper transcript of an interview and the audio, and then you keep one in a different location. So the transcript is kept, you know, in the basement, and the audio is kept on your hard drive or on the cloud or something like that. And basically it's just giving you more chances that if the basement floods or if the hard drive crashes, you know, the other one will survive.
Oh, yeah. You learn that lesson once when you lose something. So
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It's one of those things where, you know, the most common question that anyone will ask, and I'm anticipating everyone asking on Wednesday, what questions do you ask? And it's so different for everyone. You know, you're not going to ask a Vietnam veteran the same questions that you're going to ask your 93-year-old grandmother, you know. And that's why when people ask me to do interviews of their family, it doesn't make much sense because I don't know them the same way that they know them. So, you know,
yeah,
what the best question is.
Exactly. It's bringing those things up that, I mean, you kind of know about it anyways, but you were maybe, you know, along those family lines, it's like you were in the backseat of the car, you know,
sure.
And it's just like, well, can you tell us about that one time we drove through Maine, you know, and we saw that thing and, oh yeah, that's right. And they just kind of go off on that. Whereas somebody who's outside the family, you have no idea. So, well, anything else you'd like to add about the Historical Society oral histories?
You know, they're online and they're fully available, which is something that we've worked really hard for. You know, if there's ever an issue that anyone comes up with, contact us directly. You know, being one of the first organizations to take their oral history collection fully online, there's been some bumps along the way. I think we've ironed most of them out now, but we're always looking to talk to people about their experience with oral history, so we're here to help.
Nice. And if somebody does want to get a hold of you, I mean, how would they go about doing that?
Email is probably the easiest way. It's just my name, Ryan, R-Y-A-N, .Barland, B-A-R-L-A-N-D, at mnhs.org.
Excellent. Well, Ryan, hey, thanks for talking with us today.
I appreciate it. It was a lot of fun.
Once again, you've been listening to the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota. And this week we've had Ryan Barland from the Minnesota Historical Society Oral History Project. For more information on the Breakfast Club at 9 a.m. on Wednesday, June 10th, you can find links on their website at stearns-museum.org under Breakfast Club. And for more information on the Minnesota Historical Society Oral History Project, you can find it on their website at www.mnhs.org. This has been Arts and Cultural Heritage producer Jeff Carmack, and the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota is made possible through support of the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. It has been produced at KVSC, a proud member of AMPERS, Divers Radio for Minnesota's communities.